Okay. All right. Firstly, Erev Tov, I want to explain where we're going to go in the next couple of shiurim. We're doing this on a two-week basis. And one of the things that last time, I hope, was brought home quite forcefully, I hope, was the fact that we really do need to know Tanakh. We need to know our Bible. Very often Bible gets a very, I don't know what the word is, we kind of become a bit indifferent to it, because, you know, Parsha we hear every week, and we get the same speeches all the time, and, you know, we need, there's just such a wealth, not just a wealth, but there's a wisdom there, and the wisdom that comes into Bible study is something, particularly Tanakh, you know, sort of Nevi'im, Ketuvim, etc., things that we don't normally get to study in depth. There is a staggering amount of wisdom there, and what I want to do is spend maybe a couple of sessions talking about a book that we all know, the book of Ruth. We've all studied it, we've all come across it. Let me just show you on the screen. Hopefully I can do this. No, you see, I can't. I need a share screen, which I haven't got. Basically, what happens in the book of Ruth, just to give you as an example, there's a guy that we know called Elimelech, right? I'm just giving this by way of an example. And we know the story that he runs away from Eretz Israel. It's a drought. It's the time of the judges, Vayehi bimei shvot ha-shoftim, right? And it says Elimelech ran away with Naomi, and he had two sons, Mahlon and Kilion, and he goes to Moab, which today is essentially running away to Jordan, right? As that means he's leaving Eretz Israel and running to Jordan, which in itself is amazing. The rabbis say he was the God Ladon, he was the greatest man of the generation. Certainly was the wealthiest guy in Israel. And yet, he picks himself up and he runs away to Moab, right? And what happens at the beginning of the story? We know that there is a terrible event that takes place, that firstly Elimelech dies, and then the two sons die, and before they die, they marry princesses of Moab. One's called Ruth, and one's called Orpah, right? We know this story. This is a story we've grown up on over the years. And eventually what happens is that we know that not only does Elimelech die, but eventually the two sons have died. And before you look around, this whole story revolves around the relationship between whoever's left, Naomi, the famous wife of Elimelech, and the two girls, Ruth and Orpah, right? Ruth says, I will go with you, where you go, I will go. And Orpah is persuaded to go home, to go back to Moab. And the rabbis ask the obvious question, you know, it's a very nice story. Thank you so much. And it's in the Bible, which is all well and good, but why? What is this story, what does it add to my existence? How does it embellish my Jewish life? How does it give me something which I can then use and take away from the story, you know, lessons and moral teachings and everything else? It's so strange. It's a very, I would say, you know, it does become a very wonderful story in terms of people caring for each other. But what's the real essence of this story? What is actually going on? What is the background to this story? And it's so challenging and it's so interesting. And I tell you why it's interesting, because today we witness something I never believed I'd ever see, certainly not see anything like that happening in Washington, of all places. It was the most scary thing, right? We say in the Pirkei Avot, and I'll tell you why this is interesting. This may shock you, but in Pirkei Avot, it says, we read it in the third chapter of Pirkei Avot, Rab Chanina Skana Kohenim, Rab Chanina was one of the priests in the temple, right? Very famous. He says, Havei mitpalel b'shlomo shel malchut, pray for the peace of the kingdom in which you find yourself, the country, because if it's not for the fear, most rabbis say it means the fear of God, that there is this sense of what we would nowadays say the rule of law. If it wasn't for that, ish esreyu chayim b'lo'o, everybody will be swallowing their fellow man whole, right, alive. And you think to yourself, whoa, that's a pretty intense statement. Till I watch what was going on this afternoon at about 4 o'clock, when I realized that this Mishnah is really something we should bear in mind. To pray for the peace of the welfare of the country in which we live. Right? Something which in the United States they said an attack on the capital hasn't taken place since they rubbed it in, and since the British did it about 200 years ago. 1814, go figure. The last time that there was such an attack on the capital. Unbelievable. And basically what I want to do is I want to talk a bit about the Book of Ruth and really give it a little bit of a twist which we may never have thought of, you know, in any way up to this point. Now, why do I do this? Because I want to say the following, and it really needs an introduction. About, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago, pre-COVID, right, when we could actually travel, I was in Israel, and we went to visit my mother-in-law. And in fact, today I want to dedicate the shiur in memory of my father-in-law. It's Yahrzeit, was yesterday, 22nd of Tevet. Passed away. He was 86 years old in Yerushalayim. It was his 10th Yahrzeit. And again, I could spend the whole evening just talking about him. Very, very unique individual, very special man, very religious, came from the strong German background. You know, Frankfurt, born and bred, Yeki, the real deal. And at the same time, was really a very much in the forefront of his particular scientific study. He built computers when nobody knew what a computer was. The first computer in Israel, which was built in the 1950s, now in the Weizmann Institute, still there, was his project. It's called the Sabruk. Okay, you know, like as in the Sabra. And it was a computer which was built purely with components made in Israel. And in fact, the only reason why my parents don't left Israel is because the Prime Minister, Ben Gurion, encouraged him to do it. But the next Prime Minister, what was his name? Eshkol, decided that he asked him, he came to see the project, and in 1964, and he said, is it cheaper if we build this in America? And the answer had to be yes, because, you know, it's already, they've got the parts. IBM was already doing it. So the project folded up, and my father-in-law, my parents-in-law, went to live in America, and they went, in fact, he went to work for IBM. That's exactly what happened. And there's more to that history, but no question, very, very interesting gentleman, very, what I call the real Torah mother, person. Torah mother meaning Torah and science. He was always learning, always had a Gemara open. At the same time, he was really incredibly advanced in his scientific study. He wrote a book on his particular subject. Really was an interesting man, and again, may his memory be for a blessing. The story goes like this. When I was in Israel, I walked into one of the bookshops in Meir Shearim, which I occasionally do. And I said to the guy serving there, I said, I'm looking for something interesting on the Book of Ruth, because I was beginning to teach the Book of Ruth at YU. So I didn't want to get into a discussion with him, what's YU, because, you know, probably wouldn't even understand. But he said to me, I've got a sefer, have a look at this. And he gave me this book, and it's a book written by a rabbi who died in the year 1919. Right? So it's just over 100 years ago. And fascinating. The gentleman's name was Elio Akiva Rabinowitz. Nobody's ever heard of him. I would guarantee that if you stood up in shul on Shabbos and said, has anyone heard of this rabbi? The answer would be an absolute deafening silence. They haven't heard of him. But what's the story with Rabbi Rabinowitz, who died in just over 100 years ago? So the story is like this. He was a man of Eastern Europe. He was a rabbi in a town, I think, called Poltava in Poland. And he was a very well-read gentleman. Not only was he very learned, but he was also very well-read. He was very well in the Torah subject, but also in general knowledge. And he decided when in 1896, interesting thing, the first Zionist Congress was announced that it would take place in Switzerland, he decided that he was going to take a delegation of very religious gentlemen, like himself, about 10 rabbis, and they wanted to go and represent religious Jews at the Zionist conference. He did not want Zionism to be totally divorced from religious input, something which he wanted to ensure. And he was there. And he actually wrote a diary. It's fascinating. He wrote a diary about the Zionist conference. And one of the most interesting things he wrote about was the Shabbos morning davening. Right? Go figure. You think that this was a very secular bunch of people. And Shabbos morning, this was in Switzerland, in where was it? In Basel, in Switzerland. And he said that halfway through the davening, Theodor Herzl came to daven. He came to shul. Right? Now, Herzl wasn't famous for his religious lifestyle at all. His children married out. They married non-Jews. But the reality was that Herzl came, and not only that, he writes about the fact Herzl got an aliyah. He was called up to the Torah. And he had a conversation with him, and he writes very encouragingly about what Herzl was putting through in terms of what they were calling secular Zionism. But of course, for Rabbi Rabinowitz, it had tremendous religious overtones. He was a man who was, he refused. In the end, he fell out with the Zionist movement. He said it's just too secular. He couldn't handle it. And in the end, what he did is that he joined the organization that was being formed at, a little bit after the Zionist Congress, and that was the Aguda, the Agudat Israel. And in 1912, in Katowice, in southern Poland, he was one of the delegates at the first Agudat Israel conference that took place at that particular time. Very interesting story. But what this Rabbi Rabinowitz writes about in his introduction to the Book of Ruth, has a commentary on the Book of Ruth. And I tell you something, it's so phenomenal. And the reason why it's phenomenal is because he is a man who knows the history of the 19th century. All I need to say to you is, 1793, French Revolution. 1848, another French Revolution, right? And a revolution in Italy and in Europe. And then, of course, you get to the early 1900s and you get the Russian Revolution. You're getting revolutions going on all over the world. And this Rabbi Rabinowitz was aware of revolutions that happened not only immediately in his particular part of the world. He lived in Poland and he knew about the Russian Revolution. But he'd also read about previous revolutions from the French Revolution and the revolution in Italy and various other countries. He knew all of this history. It's fascinating. And Rabbi Rabinowitz was really, really a man of his time. And he understood that there is a certain, how should we say, when you have a knowledge of current events, they can be used or understood as a way of applying the events which had happened currently to understand and to make sense of one of the most famous stories in the Bible. And he applied it to the Book of Ruth. And I tell you what he did. And here comes the bombshell. And it's absolutely amazing. We just spoke about the beginning of the Book of Ruth. And the Book of Ruth, we know, is, as the rabbis say, there's not really much happening. There's certainly no great halachic revelations in the Book of Ruth. All right, some say about the idea of conversion, something that we may talk about in the next session. But, you know, when you look at the Book of Ruth, you say to yourself, why was this written? And the rabbis ask the question. They say there's no tumah, there's no tahara, right? There's no real laws of purity or anything like that. So they say it's a story to teach us the value of chesed, of kindness, which is true. And that's one of the great lessons of the Book of Ruth. But the question is raised, why was this book written? And let's make a sort of bigger historical presentation and say, when was the book written? The Book of Ruth is placed historically at the time of the Judges. You've got to jump literally 100 years down the historical time tunnel till you get to a prophet that we've all heard of, the prophet Samuel, Shmuel HaNavi. And Shmuel HaNavi decides, I'm going to write the Book of Ruth. Now, again, one has to ask the obvious question, why did you sit around, wait for I don't know, something in the region of 75 to 100 years before you start writing the Book of Ruth? What possessed Shmuel in a completely different generation? Because Shmuel is not the generation of judges. Shmuel is the transition to the generation of kings. He's the one responsible for Shaul appointing King Saul. He eventually the famous anointment of King David. That's Shmuel. That's what the prophet Samuel does. So why was he so concerned to write the Book of Ruth, which is really very, very interesting, in order to preserve that story for posterity, and particularly as it was being written by Shmuel almost 100 years after the event took place? What was the reason for Shmuel to write this book? So already you've got a much bigger picture in terms of the Book of Ruth. Instead of seeing it as a very localized story happening at a time which, according to the rabbis, Boaz was one of the judges. In the book of Judges, he's known as Ivtsan. If you look at chapter 12 of the book of Judges, you'll see Boaz is mentioned there, Ivtsan. All we know about him is that he had lots of kids. That's all it says. Many sons, many daughters, and that was it. It's an interesting thing. That's all they say about him. But we know Boaz and the story of the Book of Ruth with a very, very different approach, right? You know, how caring he was, and he was the leader of the generation in his particular time. Remember, the famine that starts the whole story eventually goes away, and Eretz Yisrael, there's plenty of food in Eretz Yisrael, so Naomi and Ruth come back to Eretz Yisrael. Who looks after them? Boaz. Okay, and we'll come to all of that in due course. But what I want to talk about very, very interestingly is a bit of background to this story, which makes the story completely, and I have to say, completely different to anything that you would have realized from before. Now, let's talk about the Book of Ruth. At the beginning, a guy called Elimelech. Elimelech was the great, great leader of the generation. All of what I'm going to say to you is based on the writings of Rabbi Rabinowitz, right? And again, I'm sorry I don't have the text, because I would actually go through the text a little bit to show you what exactly I'm doing. For next time, well, hopefully we'll have a screen with a text. But listen to this, and this is really comes as a bit of a shock. What happened was the following. Rabbi Rabinowitz explains it like this. He says Elimelech, his name, was not a coincidence. All of these guys had very significant names. We've got three names, which are, well, in fact, four names. We've got the name Elimelech. We've got the name Mahlon, one of the sons. The second name, Kilion. And then, if you want to add, you can also add Naomi. And I guess you could probably add Ruth and Orpah. Orpah means the back of the neck. So why was she called Orpah? Because she turned around and went back. So what did you see? You only saw the back of her neck disappearing when she goes back to her people. And it was a very bad choice. She had a very bad time. But go back to Elimelech. Listen to this. What does the name Elimelech, how does it break down in syllables? Two syllables. The first syllable, Eli, or Eli, to me. And the second syllable, or second word, Melech, king. To me is the king. Eli, Melech. Let's look at the name Mahlon. Mahlon comes from either the Hebrew word machala, or chole, or something of that order, which means something which is unwell or is in bad shape. Kilion is even worse, because Kilion comes from the word l'chalot, which means to end, means to destroy, destruction. Machlon and Kilion represent two sons of, who are very destructive, who are really very, very, what's the word, negative, whatever word you want to use. If we understand, and of course, just for the sake of completion, what about the name Naomi? Naomi comes from the word Naim. Naim means pleasant, someone who has got pleasant character. We know Naomi is, she's got a lot of bitterness in her life, but in terms of her standing, her the way she conducts herself, she is a very pleasant individual. That we know. And even Ruth, rabbis say, comes from the word Raveh. Raveh means also something which is very shining, something which has a certain grace, a certain, what we would call in Yiddish, chen, bechent. Ruth is very, very bechent. So, put all these names together, says Rabbi Rabinowitz. He says the following, and this blows my mind. He says, the story of the book of Ruth, if we go back to the beginning of the story, and we read the first couple of verses, right? And the best I can do is read it out to you. I have it in front of me, but as I said, I'm sorry, I can't bring it up on the screen. That'll be for next time, hopefully. It starts off like this. Vayihi bimei shvot ha-shoftim. So, obviously, what is going on is that there are judges. And we know that judges, by definition, were chosen as one-shot deals. They had a judge, he was chosen, he became the judge. When he died, a new judge was chosen. And it wasn't a dynasty. The kingship was always a dynasty. Shlomo was the son of David. Rechavam was the son of Shlomo. And it goes on and on and on. When it comes to judges, they were literally one person chosen. That person could have been the judge for 1 year, could have been the judge for 25, 50 years, some were 80 years. And then they died, and a new judge was chosen. And there was usually a bit of a time gap between the choosing of the judges. So the period of judges was, by definition, not as stable as the period of kings in terms of getting a new judge. You had to wait sometimes a long time. But at the same time, it was seemed to have been open for anybody to come in and throw, as you say nowadays, throw their hat into the ring, to offer to become the leader. And Seemingly, at the time of the beginning of the book of Ruth, an election had just taken place, right? How do we know this? Because we know that Boaz was the new judge. That's the rabbinic tradition, and that is based also on, as I said, chapter 12 of the book of Judges. Have a look over there, and you'll see that Boaz came in. When Boaz came in, like with any election, there's obviously going to be a reaction, right? We don't have to go very far to see what, unfortunately, when people don't like the result, what happens as a consequence. This is the mad situation which we're in at the moment, which I hope, please God, another 13 days and we can move on. Because it's not normal what we experience today. But listen to this. It's unbelievable. When Boaz was chosen, who else had thrown their hat into the ring? Who was eligible to become a judge? So says Rabbi Rabinowitz, again based on rabbinic tradition, Elimelech. He was one of the great leaders of the Jewish people. So he had thrown his hat into the ring, and he had wanted to become the judge. And you know what? He lost. Right? You know, Biden won and the other guy lost. And in those days, it was it was an election. So what happened? Boaz won. Elimelech lost. So you'll say to me, fine, transition of power. Elimelech disappears from the situation. He's out of it. He's gone. Not so fast. Elimelech seems to have had, and this is his name, Eli Melech. To me, is kingship. Elimelech had this image of himself as being the obvious person to be the judge. So what does Elimelech do if he loses the election? He doesn't sit around and sort of, you know, sort of, what's the word, like they do, you know, sit around and sort of just lick your wounds. He goes to Moab. He disappears. Let me read the verse to you. Vayhi b'mei shvot ha-shoftim, the days during when they had the election of the judges, and the verse tells you there was an election. Vayhi ra'av ba'aretz, and there was a famine in Eretz Yisrael at the same time. Vayelech ish mi beit lechem Yudah. Ish is always an important person. So this man went from Beit Lechem in Yehuda, from Bethlehem, Lagur b'stei Moab. He goes to the fields of Moab, meaning he goes across the Allenby Bridge, and he ends up in Jordan. Hu v'ishto shtei banav. He goes with his family. Now again, you ask maybe the obvious question, why does he leave Eretz Israel? But more to the point, he goes to Moab. What was the relationship between Israel and Moab during the period of the judges? And we can only go by evidence of what is written there, that the relationship was incredibly bad. Moab was not a friend of the Jewish people. They never were. When the Jews came to Eretz Israel and they went through the territory of Moab and they asked Moab for help, Moab refused, didn't want to give them bread, didn't want to give them water, nothing. Moab was never going to be one of the friends of the Jewish people. So it begs the question, why does Elimelech, after losing the Shvot HaShoftim, the election to be the judge, why is he going off to Moab? What does he hope to achieve by living in that place? What is he doing? And here comes Rabbi Rabinowitz with a bombshell. And that's why I was thinking today how incredibly relevant this story is to what we're experiencing at the moment in the 21st century in the United States. Listen to this. Rabbi Rabinowitz says, he looked around the world in his day, and he said he saw nations where people, groups get together. They sometimes come from what I suppose you would call it in Russia, the proletariat, the workers. And they came in, and what did they do? They became the group which tried to take over and become powerful in the country. The Russian Revolution, what was that all about? Trotsky and Lenin and all these characters, right? They were literally representing the people, according to the theory. And basically what happened was, says Rabbi Rabinowitz, that this concept of someone trying to take over based on popular power, on the popular vote, is something, he said, which in fact is found in the biblical story of Elimelech and his two sons. He said Elimelech went to Moab. Elimelech was devastated that he lost the election. So he's got two choices. As I said, lick your wounds and just disappear into, you know, go and live in Florida, as they say. Or, what can Elimelech do? He can fight back. How does Elimelech fight back? He makes the following suggestion. Rabbi Rabinowitz says that, and it blows my mind. He says, Elimelech went to Moab, because he knew that Moab did not like the Jews. So he turns up, the most famous, powerful Jew from Israel, and he goes to the Moabite leadership, and he says to the Moabites, he says, listen guys, I don't like my brethren, they just did not vote me into a position where I should have been the vote, I should have been the leader, I should have been voted in. And you know what, they rejected me. I want to go back to Israel and take over and stage a coup. I want to go and I want to take an army which will go to Eretz Israel with me in order to take over the country. I don't know whose voice I'm hearing.
Sorry.
Okay, sorry about that. So listen to this, because if you follow this, it is quite unbelievable. This is the Book of Ruth, right? Which I hope everybody knows, but all of a sudden the whole story takes on a whole different presentation. Again, Elimelech has lost the election. So what does Elimelech decide to do? He decides to raise a force and to overthrow the results of the election. As I said, it's just mind-blowing how this became so connected to events that we seem to be living through at the moment. How do you do that? In the case of Elimelech, he would go to the country next door and he would say to them, I want to raise an army so that I can come back to Eretz Israel and I can bring an army to Israel and take over the country. That's what Elimelech wants to do. Unbelievable suggestion. Hi, Elise.
Hi.
Hi there. You're right in the middle of this. I'll go over it again in a few minutes.
It's okay, it's my fault.
it's a fascinating thing that the Book of Ruth and the
Susan, can you mute yourself?
Sorry, just I think a second.
There you go. That's it. Now you're muted. Again, I'm trying to pad this out a bit because it really is a whole different approach. Let me say very, very briefly. Elimelech lost the election to be the judge. Right, Elimelech was a powerful guy. We know that from the beginning of the Book of Ruth. So what does he do? He doesn't take it lying down. He wants to become the judge. So he goes to the land of Moab, Sedei Moab, the fields of Moab. Say the rabbis, why the fields? Because it was temporary. You go to a field, you set up a tent and you live there. You camp for a few weeks, but you don't set up a home in a field. The field is a temporary place. So he goes to Moab as a temporary measure to raise an army, believe it or not, so that he can come back and he can fight for the leadership of the Jewish people in Eretz Israel. He can become the new judge. He would even be prepared to go against Boaz. And Boaz, we know, was the leader who was chosen at the time, chapter 12 of the book of Shoftim, as I mentioned before. Boaz was the new judge. But Elimelech had plans. He wanted to overthrow. So he's in the land of Moab, raising an army. In parentheses, as I mentioned before, Shmuel HaNavi, 100 years later, is writing down this story. And the question, which really is the question of the evening, is why? Why did Shmuel feel it was necessary to preserve this story, particularly the way that we're explaining it in the view of Rabbi Rabinowitz, this rabbi who lived just over 100 years ago? And the answer is absolutely amazing. Again, back to the story. Elimelech is in Moab. He's in Jordan. And he's raising an army to go back to Eretz Israel. And we know that he's there with his two sons, Mahlon and Kilion. Now again, by what we said before, by the very fact of their names being so negative, and in fact the rabbis say that there are other names which they are referred to in other Svarim, which are not negative names. So the name here is significant. It says about them, Ephratim, that they were princes. So not only did Elimelech himself consider himself to be the person fitting to become the judge, but his two sons supported him, right? Eric and Donald Jr., I mean, you know, go and put names on them. And they are supporting him to say, you should become the person to maintain your leadership and carry on and be the person running the country. And Elimelech, as it were, accepts this, you know, without question, and he's gone off to Moab to raise an army. Because in Moab, as we said before, one of the things that the Moabites did not like is Am Yisrael. They didn't like the Jews. So you'll say to me, why did they talk to Elimelech? But again, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Elimelech says, I don't like my brothers. They did a very bad thing to me. I want to take over the country. And you know what? If you help me, you know, you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. You'll get a lot of benefit from it. So they agreed. So Elimelech is raising an army. Unbelievable. And of course, what happens is that within a very short period of time, we know the story, verse 3, Vayamat Elimelech Ishnomi, he dies in the middle of what he's trying to do, and it obviously takes more than 5 minutes. He's got the finances. He's a wealthy, wealthy man. So he's got to, you know, he's got a schmear. He's got to make sure that everyone buys into his plan. And eventually, before he gets it all together, he dies. So Vatishaehi Shnei Banai, it says that Naomi is left with her two sons. Just to say a little bit more, and then I'm going to go back to Shmuel and explain to you what's going on. The story which everybody gets very upset about is the marriage of Ruth and Orpah, the two sisters, to the two sons of Elimelech. How could these two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, nice Jewish boys, marry these non-Jewish princesses? Ruth and Orpah were princesses of Midian. So how could they marry? And Ibn Ezra says, impossible that they married out, impossible. They must have converted Ruth and Orpah with some sort of conversion. Again, as I said, we'll talk about it when we get into more of the detail. But I'm giving you a kind of overview at the moment. So, one of the interesting suggestions that, again, Rabbi Rabinowitz says is that the fact is they married these two princesses. Think about it for a second. It makes perfect sense that they married them because Elimelech had died, but the sons wanted to carry on their father's enterprise. How do you carry on the enterprise of building a coalition against your own people? By endearing yourself to the leadership. How do you endear yourself? This is political history from the last 2,000 years. You marry the princesses of the country. And of course, what did Mahlon and Chilion do? They married Ruth and Orpah. And you know what? They weren't Jewish at the time. They converted later on, and Ruth becomes a very wonderful example of a good Jewish girl, but that's later. But at the beginning of the story, Ruth and Orpah are marrying, literally, Mahlon and Chilion are marrying Ruth and Orpah in order to continue the enterprise of building the army so that they can go back and continue what their father started, but the father died, Elimelech was not around, to go and take over the land of Israel by force. Now, I read this and I say, this is unbelievable. Because what Rabbi Rabinowitz does, he takes 19th century history, world history, and he's applied it to the Book of Ruth. And he said that the Book of Ruth represents in its essence a story at the beginning of someone who had, ideas of grandeur, of power, someone who couldn't let go, someone who had lost an election and could not allow himself to disconnect from what had happened and had to get the leadership by whatever means he possibly could. And apart from, as I said, the events which have been going on in the last 24 hours, which just are so unbelievable that this connects one thing to the other. Let's think about Shmuel 100 years down the line from this story. We've got into the story, and Shmuel is recording this story. Why is Shmuel recording a story about a man called Elimelech, who tried to raise an army abroad, outside Israel, wanted to bring it back, and unfortunately he died, and then his sons had wanted to continue the same thing, and they died, and the whole project fizzled out. Why would Shmuel HaNavi, the author of the Book of Ruth, 100 years after the events took place, why would he write this down?
Is it because Shaul, now he's having, you know, a parallel situation with Shaul?
And that's the whole key to the Book of Ruth. The Book of Ruth, which we thought was such a nice, pleasant, and it is a wonderful story, is one of the most loaded political intrigues in the whole Bible. Because there are two issues which have to be sorted out in the time of Shmuel. Number one is Saul, and the fact that Saul had lost the kingship, meaning the whole story with Amalek, and he didn't kill the Amalekites, and he wasn't going to be the king to continue. And Saul was having a lot of issues accepting that circumstance. And even more than that, here comes the real bombshell. If it's not going to be Saul, then who's it going to be instead? Now we know it's going to be David. David got anointed by Shmuel. Shmuel anointed David. But there's a problem with the anointment of David. And the problem with the anointment of David is that David descends from Ruth. She'll say to me, wonderful yichas, Ruth is a wonderful woman. Big problem. The problem is Ruth Jewish? Why is there a problem about Ruth being Jewish? Because she was a Moabite. And the rabbis say that when the Torah spoke about the Moabites, as we mentioned before, and they were not our friends, it turned out that the Moabites were not allowed to become part of the Jewish people. Lo yovo amoni u'moavi b'kahal Hashem. They're not allowed to become Jewish. So the rabbis then, in the time of Boaz, and later on in the time of Shmuel, made a massive, massive exception to the rule. And they said that the Torah speaks in the masculine. So the Torah is saying the men cannot convert, but the women absolutely can become Jewish. Therefore, Ruth, by definition, is a bona fide Jew. And if David is the great grandson of Ruth, which he is, then David, by definition, is a good kosher Jew. And David is 100% eligible to become the king of Israel. Only one problem, and here we go with the politics. There was a gentleman in the time of David, and he was contemporary with Shmuel. And this guy was known as Doeg. You may not have heard of his name, but he is a real troublemaker. What's so interesting about Doeg? It says he was the head of the Sanhedrin, so he was a big rabbi, serious beard, but at the same time, he was a troublemaker. And what was his thing? His thing was that he did not accept that women coming from Moab can become Jewish. He questioned the whole tradition going back to the days of Ruth, when Ruth was converted to become Jewish. And he made what you say in Yiddish, a tumult. He started making a campaign, propaganda, against David. David, in his generation, was destined to become the king. He'd done away with Goliath, and you know, David was famous. Along comes this guy, Doeg, and he says, listen, guys, you want this upstart David to be the king? He's not Jewish. How can you have David as the king? He comes from Ruth. And Ruth, by definition, was not Jewish because she is a Moabite. So they say, Doeg, you're wrong. Boaz allowed it, and Shmuel is going to allow it. And, you know, get your facts right. So Doeg says, and he's the troublemaker of his generation. You always got one in every generation, right? And he turns around and says, I don't accept those decisions because they were not made by the courts. They were made by individuals, Boaz on his own. Maybe Boaz had other reasons for doing it. And even Shmuel, I'm going to question Shmuel. The rabbis bring a phenomenal story. It says Doeg got so worked up about this that he went to the Beit Midrash. And he walked into the Beit Midrash and he said, Rabbatai, rabbis. He said, is David a kosher Jew? And the rabbi said, of course he's a kosher. Look at what a wonderful guy. He's just killed Goliath and he's winning all the wars. What do you mean is he a kosher Jew? Of course he's kosher. So Doeg said, well, wait a minute. He comes from Ruth. Ruth is not necessarily kosher Jewess. She was converted and maybe she's not eligible to be Jewish. So it's an incredible story. So the rabbi says, Gemara Yevamot, page 76. You have to look up this Gemara. The Gemara says that what happened was, there's a guy called Amasa ben Yeter, the head of the army. And he takes out his sword, like, you know, Excalibur, you know, one of these great swords. And he puts it in the ground, in the Beit Midrash. And he says, Rabotai, listen, anyone who doubts that David is Jewish is going to have to deal with the sword of Amasa. In other words, if you're going to disagree with David's definition of Jewishness, then I personally will make sure that your disagreement means that you're considered a rebel and you will be put to death. And that was the end of the discussion. But until you got to that point, there was enormous uproar. Is David fit to be Jewish? Now, with this introduction, and this is just the introduction to the book, you'll understand what Shmuel HaNavi was worried about and why he had to write this story down for posterity. Shmuel HaNavi realized that as much as the argument of Doeg in his generation, this guy Doeg, who made such a fuss about David, came along and doubted whether David was Jewish. And they had to have this showdown, high noon, with a sword in the middle of the Beit Midrash. Not the way they do it today, thank God. But whatever it is, you know, this sort of thing going on. Unbelievable. Really unbelievable. And come another 100 years down the line, what's going to stop another Doeg, whoever he may be, turning round and saying to the whole Jewish world, that guy David, who started the dynasty of the kingship of Israel, you know what? He wasn't Jewish. And people will start saying, what do you mean he's not Jewish? How can you say that? David, King David. And all of a sudden, you're going to have the same argument over and over and over again throughout history. To the point where Mashiach is not going to happen. Because eventually David becomes the great, 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 whatever, grandfather of Mashiach. But if David is not considered to be Jewish, then Mashiach can't be descended from David. We're going to be stuck. Mashiach ben David. This is what we know. But how? So what Shmuel HaNavi decides to do is to write down the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth is a beautiful, wonderful, such an inspiring story. But the agenda of the book of Ruth is so much bigger. It's a beautiful story about how Ruth cares for her mother-in-law, Naomi, and they go back to Eretz Israel, and eventually Boaz gets involved to look after them, and should he marry her, and the Ploni Almoni, and all of that stuff, which, in fact, I've just given an exam on this to my students. I've called it small picture. Everything that you read in the book of Ruth is essentially small picture. It's the small events, so-called small picture, but they're beautiful. It's a beautiful story. But what is the big picture? What is really going on in the book of Ruth? Why did the prophet Shmuel write it down? What was bugging him that he had to write down the book of Ruth? And not only that he wrote it down, but this is, as I said, 100 years after the event. So if he is writing this down and putting it into the Bible, right, then it's there for a purpose. In fact, I always comment that if you, you know, when you stay in a hotel, in the drawer, in the bedroom, there's always a Gideon Bible, right, which is a non-Jewish Bible. Always interests me, the order of the books of the Bible. And if you open up the Gideon Bible, you look for the book of Ruth, it comes right next to the book of Judges. It's not the way we have it. We have all of the Megillah, Ruth and Shirah Shirim. We have it all in a separate section because we put it in there according to the calendar. We read, we have Shirah Shirim, the first book of the year, Pesach. We have the book of Ruth, Shavuos, and then we have Eicha, Tisha B'Av, and we get through eventually to Kohelet. So we have the books written as a, put as a separate section in Tanakh, reflecting the Jewish calendar. But the non-Jewish version of events is historical. So they put the book of Ruth immediately next to the book of Judges. And you know what? It's not such a bad suggestion. Because the fact is that the book of Judges reflected what was clearly massive issues, incredible challenges of the day. The biggest issue at the time was the eligibility of Ruth to become Jewish. Because remember, once Ruth goes back to Eretz Israel, one of the big discussions is about Ruth's eligibility in terms of marriage and everything else that's going to go on, which, Mitzvah Shem, I hope next time we'll talk about in a bit more detail. But more to the point, the interesting thing, when they come back to Eretz Israel and the whole establishment of Ruth's situation and who and what she is, that for Shmuel HaNavi is paramount to be recorded, even if it's 100 years after the event, for the simple reason that Shmuel understands that if he does not record these events in a book in the Bible, which is written by Ruach HaKodesh, and therefore people will be very, what's the word, they won't treat it so lightly, they'll realize that it's been written for a purpose, then all of the sting of that stigma against David because he's descended from Ruth, that will go away completely. And the end of the book of Ruth is so revealing. After the whole story, what does it do right at the end? It gives us the lineage. This one was descended from that one. And that one comes from this one. And eventually, Yishai, and who is the son of Yishai? The Yishai, Holid, Ed, David. Because the book of Ruth is there to establish the credentials of David forever and ever. It is a book which has a major purpose. That purpose being that whenever anyone would come along in the future in Jewish history and start saying David is not one of us, he's certainly not eligible to be the king of Israel, that discussion now will never ever take place ever again. If you see it like this, then you see that the book of Ruth, all of a sudden, has become one of it's become a major political statement in terms of the eligibility of David to become the king of Israel. The story of Elimelech, why he himself was in fact disqualified. And if you think about it, Doeg, this guy, what's Doeg all about? Why does he claim that David is not eligible? Because he wants the job. Because Doeg thinks, you know, I should be not. I'm not going to be the king because I don't have the dynasty. But you know what? We'll go back to judges. And Doeg says to himself, you know, I'm eligible to be the judge, like Elimelech was. So can I be the judge? So what does Shmuel say? Shmuel writes the book of Ruth to prove that that is, by definition, that is pasul, that is invalid. Once we finish with the judges, we are done. So Doeg, you're in the period of David, you're in the period of Saul, you're in the period of kings. We're never going to go back to judges ever again. That was a period in Jewish history which we don't really want to go back to. It didn't turn out so great. So as a consequence, Shmuel HaNavi is going to establish and write down forever and ever in the book of Ruth the definitive history of King David. And once that is established, we can move from the story of the book of Ruth and go through Jewish history till we eventually get to the Mashiach. And without it, and Shmuel HaNavi knows this, without it, the whole messianic enterprise is always going to be on, how should we say, terra not firma, if you understand what I'm saying. It's never going to be 100%, because there's always going to be someone making trouble. Someone is going to come along and say that the results of the election are false, that what's going on is wrong, that what happened is a mistake. As Elimelech tried to do, and as Doeg is trying to do in his generation, and says Shmuel HaNavi, enough is enough. I know that this has been going on since Ruth became Jewish, but now, once and for all, the book of Ruth is there to establish who is the real deal. David is real, Elimelech is not real, and Doeg for sure is out of it. And of course, you'll know, if you we'll talk about the history of Doeg and find out what happened to him. Not a happy ending.
Isn't there one other factor here, which is Shaul, you know, even without the issue of David's credibility, wanted, you know, would want his own sons to be the king.
Correct,
right?
Correct.
Jonathan and others to ascend and keep the house, his house and his line going, as opposed to turning it over to a different tribe.
Absolutely. And that, again, is part of Shmuel's idea that to establish once and for all that when Shaul made a mistake, he messed up, this was permanent. There was no going back. Shaul, King Saul, cannot come along later on after the events of Amalek, the whole story there, and turn around and say, I want to go back to square one. He lost it. And who is now in place of Shaul? David. Now, it doesn't happen overnight. David is not confirmed from day one. The anointment, remember, was private. It wasn't a public anointment yet. But it doesn't matter. The process has begun. And that, by definition, means that Shmuel is really being responsible for the future. You know what? You know why this is so fascinating? Because we always talk about Jewish life based on oral tradition. Our tradition is an oral tradition. But when it came to this, the establishment of kingship, Shmuel says you can have all the oral traditions in the world, but if you don't write this down and have it in your constitution or wherever you want to put it, what we call Tanakh, then it's never going to be 100%. There's always going to be someone coming along, Doeg, or there's going to be Elimelech, whoever it is, and they're going to start questioning the truth. And fascinating. Yes, please, Eitan.
Is Shmuel implying by writing this down as he did that Elimelech's death was divine retribution?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Elimelech was one of the most frustrating men in the Bible. He could have financed the whole country out of its predicament. It says that he just was unprepared to put his hand in his pocket for any purpose. Absolutely unprepared to do anything and not even repentant about it. Of course, if you say that he's raising an army, which means that he had to put his hand in his pocket and raise money, to raise an army, then of course it makes his whole focus and his whole prioritization wrong. Because where is he prioritizing to raise an army? When it comes to helping people, Nebuchadnezzar, who are starving, he doesn't want to know. Alright, do you see what's going on here? And not only is Elimelech punished, but Mahlon and Kilion are also, their names are nicknames. Because they, by definition, should not have followed their father's example. They should have seen that this was not the way to spend your fortune. They should have gone back on it and they should have brought everyone back to Eretz Israel, and they didn't. They carried on, you know, as I said, this one junior carried on what the senior had already started.
What happened to the great wealth? Because by the time Naomi goes back, they're destitute, right?
When you're raising an army, that's it. The money goes. The money's gone. And it's one of the questions which we always ask, why did Naomi go back? Why was she so poor that she couldn't even, you know, she had to send Ruth to go and collect the barley so that they had something to eat? And the answer is because Elimelech was absolutely 100% irresponsible with the finances, which he obviously ran away with. He took the coffers with him. But by the time he'd spent all that money trying to raise an army, it all blown. Everything had disappeared. And as I said, it's such an original approach to the story and turns the book of Ruth from something which we're used to into a story about, wow, someone trying to raise an army to go and take over, become a judge in Israel, and the lessons and the moral lessons that come out of this story. It changes the whole perspective of the story. And again, had this come from a source which I wasn't comfortable with, I wouldn't have shared it with you. But it's coming from what really, if you see a picture of this guy, I'll have to, next time we'll do a share screen, I'll have to show you a picture of this rabbi who wrote this commentary. You know, he was really mainstream. As I said at the beginning, he was a rabbi who lived just over 100 years ago and had originally attended the Zionist Congress in 1896. He wanted a religious presence at the Zionist Congress, which, in fact, in the end, was something that he gave up on because he just couldn't handle the secular nature of Zionism at the time. But he writes a diary, which is fascinating, his interaction with Herzl and with Nordau and all the secular Achad Ha'Ami. He met them all. And he writes about them, and not so disparaging. You know, some of them he definitely did not relate to, but some of them he did. And this was a rabbi that was prepared to use his knowledge of the world around him in order to explain not only his current situation in the end of the 19th century, but the Book of Ruth, which is going back 2,500 years. Because he saw the politics of the Book of Ruth is essentially a story which repeats itself over and over again. Somebody who lost an election wants to get power by whatever means possible. As I said, it gave me the goosebumps when I was preparing this today, realizing that I'm watching on TV the plot which I'm talking about in the Book of Ruth this evening, and it was all happening this afternoon in Washington. It's a scary thing. And the reality of it is that, you know what? Plus ça change. There's always something you can learn from Tanakh. It's about you know, respecting the institution. Surely that's got to be one of the messages of the Book of Ruth. Elimelech did not respect the institution, and his sons didn't respect the institution. And as a consequence, and this is the point that Eitan made, a divine punishment. They weren't given permission to become the leaders that they should have been. They should have been people who really led Am Yisrael to a new and greater situation, and they just messed up completely. And I wanted to share all of this with you because it is so original and just so different and so unusual that I hope it whets your appetite for what we're going to do, looking at, you know, sort of we'll spend maybe a couple of sessions looking at the different chapters, dealing with some of what I call the more small picture things, and also dealing with some of these big issues which we need to come back to, because there's more of this stuff as we go along. It is truly remarkable that the Book of Ruth, who knew, was not only this wonderful story of this very, very beautiful family when it comes together eventually, but was, and it has ramifications for, not only for leadership, for kingship, ultimately for messianic leadership in the future. That's what the Book of Ruth is really about. So as I said a couple of weeks ago, I'm in love with this stuff because it's just so inspiring to learn the Book of Ruth in such a way. And Bezrat Hashem, in a couple of weeks' time, I hope, maybe with a bit more participation, let's get the word out there again, that people will come in, we'll do a little bit of review, and Bezrat Hashem, we'll take it a little bit further. We've still got to discuss the marriages because it's a problem. Right? Did they convert the women before at the beginning or not? And a lot of other very fascinating, really, really eye-opening issues in terms of the story of the Book of Ruth. Mitz Hashem, to be continued. Any comments?
Paul, do you have a question? I see it says Paul Berlin raised his hand.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, hi.
Hi. So, Rabbi, using your expertise history, the fact that you're originally British...
Yeah.
What do you think will happen in our country?
Oh,
you think God's going to punish Trump?
I think he's punishing us. I don't know about Trump.
Well, for sure.
I think we're the ones that have got to do cheshbon ha-nefesh. I tell you something. Mm. All I heard today, which I mentioned right at the beginning, that the last time this happened against the capital was with the British trying to take it over in 1814. That's the last time. So all I can say to you is, how scary is that? You know, that we're talking about that kind of jump in history. I just don't know what to say. I, you know, when I look at the Book of Ruth and what we've just said, and how certain institutions have to be respected, you know, I started off with the famous thing in Pirkei Avot, that we've got to pray for the peace of the country in which we live. Because if we don't, then Chaim Bela'o, it says, they'll swallow you alive. And that's frightening, because today we saw what could happen. Somebody died, somebody was shot, and she died, because of all this madness that was going on in Washington. So I think the message of the Book of Ruth, and really what's going on for us, is that those institutions, we've got to do everything to protect them. Democracy, I mean, everything was said today was really 100% true. And let's hope that in 14 days' time, all of this is like a very bad, bad dream. Let's move on. Let's hope that we'll deal, you know, we're out of COVID in another few months and everything will, you know, sort of just become this horrible nightmare, which unfortunately we're living through at the moment. So, Paul, your point is absolutely spot on. I don't know what to say. I'm not God, so I'm not going to answer the question for God. I can't do that.
I'm not expecting it. But as a Brit, I'm wondering, how did the British look at this? The Americans deserve it?
I hate to I know Boris Johnson said that he made a comment today that he hopes the transition of power will be smooth after this. But they're all going to say that. They're all going to say
it's with sugar.
Yeah,
it's... All right, you've said
it's...
Thank you so much, Rabbi Schaffer, and we look forward to continuing the Book of Ruth together. I apologize for my delay, and...
Not a problem.
All of us should spread the word so that we build the...
Thank you.
I hope so, and I hope next time we'll really get into more nitty-gritty. I look forward to that.
Thank you.
Wish everybody well. Take care, everybody. Have a good evening. Well.